type of rockets that recently hit a major U.S. base in Iraq was the one used by resistance forces between 2006 and 2010. The International Criminal Court opens a formal probe into Israeli war crimes in Palestinian territories. And the French president admits that French soldiers tortured and killed a top Algerian independence figure in 1957, but stopped short of issuing an apology. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in for World News. Now our top story, rockets have hit Ain al-Assad air base in western Iraq, which hosts foreign forces, including U.S. troops. Security sources says two American contractors were killed and six injured in the attack. They said a type of 10 rockets which targeted the base were the ones used by resistance forces between 2006 and 2010. According to sources, attack caused material damage to the position of foreign forces inside the base. There's no immediate claim of responsibility. Also on Wednesday, Iraqi media reported three separate attacks on convoys of U.S.-led coalition, with one being targeted near the capital, Baghdad. American forces and their logistics convoys have been targeted frequently in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Baghdad-based reporter from IRIB Bureau, Navi Behrouz, earlier joined us and gave us more details about the latest attack on Ain al-Assad.
10 rockets of Katyusha type were fired from the Al-Bayadur hit, which is located near this base. Those rockets were fired from that area and targeted Ain al-Assad air base. 10 Katyusha rockets hit that base. Based on the incoming reports, they landed at the southern part of the air base, that is where the dormitory of American forces is located, and immediately after the attack, we witnessed sorties and flights by American helicopters and aircraft over the Ain al-Assad air base, and also columns of smoke were seen rising from Ain al-Assad base. The eyewitnesses are saying that so far no group has claimed responsibility for the attack, and this attack definitely was in response to an earlier attack last week by the U.S. against the popular mobilization units forces here in the same province, Al-Anbar province. It happened on the Iraqi soil. This attack is in response to that attack, and resistance groups had already announced that they would respond to the U.S. attack. So this attack is probably a response to the U.S. attack, and that proves that resistance groups have proved that they are capable of responding to American attacks despite all security measures adopted by the U.S. military in that area.
The Iraqi Prime Minister says his country is moving on the path of dialogue and agreement on scheduling withdrawal of U.S.-led forces from the country. Mustafa al-Khadimi made the remarks during a meeting of the Ministerial Council for National Security. He said the government has the priority and needs to agree on a timetable for the departure of combat forces. He noted that strategic dialogue with Washington has so far resulted in the exit of 60% of its troops from Iraq. Anti-U.S. sentiments have been running high in the country since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January of 2020. Following the killing of the two anti-terror icons in Baghdad, Iraqi lawmakers overwhelmingly voted in parliament for the expulsion of American forces from the country. The International Criminal Court has opened a formal investigation into Israeli war crimes in Palestinian territories. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda announced the probe, assuring the court will take a principled, nonpartisan approach in discharging its responsibilities. Palestinians welcomed the decision, with Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki calling it a long-awaited step. He said the move serves Palestine's tireless pursuit of justice. However, Israel strongly opposed ICC's decision. Last month, Hague-based tribunal ruled it has jurisdiction to investigate crimes committed in the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem al-Quds. ICC is set to look into Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, its settlement activities, and regime's deadly response to anti-occupation protests in 2018. Ramallah correspondent Mona Candil joined us earlier saying the ICC move to probe Israeli crimes shows Palestinians will finally get justice.
It seems that the ICC is insisting to investigate the crimes. The Palestinian Authority, of course, has demanded the court to investigate the crimes, Israeli crimes committed in Gaza Strip in 2014, as well as what goes on in Jerusalem. Al-Quds, also the illegally built settlements in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem. Al-Quds, however, this time it seems that there will be action. But let's make it a little bit clear that Israel is not the one, as a state or a regime, will be prosecuted. However, the ICC can prosecute figures and people, Israeli officials, military officials, Israeli ministers for committing crimes. This is exactly what the Palestinian Authority has been doing in the few years ago. They collected files and continued collecting proofs that Israeli soldiers themselves and officials committed crimes against Palestinians, whether here in the occupied West Bank, in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, or even in Gaza Strip.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has defended his country's continued arms sales to Saudi Arabia despite the worsening humanitarian situation in Yemen. Johnson also stood by his government's decision to cut aid to war-torn Yemen by half, citing economic strains from the coronavirus pandemic. Keir Starmer, leader of the opposition Labour Party, slammed those decisions as unjustified. Starmer pointed out that the U.S., another major Saudi ally, put a freeze on weapons sales to the kingdom last month. Yemen has endured deaths and devastation since Saudi Arabia launched a war on the country back in early 2015. UN has already warned that the impoverished Arab nation is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. However, an international donor conference earlier this week yielded less than half the money needed to prevent what the UN said is a looming famine in Yemen. Yemen's Ministry of Water and Environment says years-long Saudi-imposed war has inflicted significant damage to the nation's water resources and facilities. It says war has cut access of thousands of Yemenis to safe water, putting their lives at risk. Our correspondent Sana Abdulatif Awashali has your story.
In a press conference held in Yemeni capital of Sana'a, the country's Ministry of Water and Environment elaborated on the damage inflicted to the water resources and infrastructure due to the Saudi-led invasion since 2015. The ministry said the war has impacted the sector severely, depriving thousands of Yemenis of access to drinking water. Officials said the war and siege imposed on the country have heavily affected the water supplies and forced millions to use unhealthy ways to store water. However, they say the severe fuel crisis has a major role in water shortage.
The per capita daily share of water consumption has dropped to 35 liters, and the lack of fuel will cause further decline and make matters worse. Water treatment and sanitation are also directly linked to fuel, so lack of fuel and the interruption in these processes may cause epidemics and endanger millions of lives.
Water resources and infrastructure are among the vital sectors that have been targeted by the Saudi-imposed war on Yemen. The war has left millions of Yemeni people without access to food and water, causing what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of Yemenis, including women and children, died of cholera during the 6 years of war. However, the Yemeni struggle to reach clean drinking water continues. The coronavirus pandemic has also worsened the situation in a country where more than 80% of people are in need of humanitarian assistance and support. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
UN human rights experts have urged Saudi Arabia to free three Shia Muslims who were detained as minors after taking part in anti-regime protests back in 2012. Experts include Agnes Calamart, UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, summary or arbitrary executions. They said Ali al-Nimr, Dawood al-Mahroun, and Abdullah al-Zahir have faced unfair trials. Experts also cited allegations of torture to extract confessions from the detainees in the kingdom.
We continue to receive allegations of torture and ill treatment to extract confessions, and in relation to the imposition of the death penalty for crimes which do not meet the threshold of most serious crimes required under international law.
The trio have been sentenced to death after their arrests, but last month a Saudi court commuted their sentences to 10 years in prison, inconclusive of the time they served. Saudi Arabia's human rights record is under growing scrutiny from rights groups and the UN. On Friday, the UN human rights chief accused the kingdom of unlawfully holding activists. Michelle Bachelet urged Riyadh to uphold the freedom of expression and right to a peaceful assembly. French President Emmanuel Macron has admitted to the colonial-era murder of top Algerian independence figures following decades of denial by Paris. Macron said the French forces detained, tortured, and killed Ali Boumendjel in Algiers in 1957 during Algeria's War of Independence. Macron, however, stopped short of issuing an official apology. French authorities had previously claimed Boumendjel had committed suicide while in custody. He was among some 1.5 million Algerians killed during the country's struggle for freedom from French rule. Eight-year war came to an end in 1962 after Algeria gained independence after over a century of French control. Earlier this year, Macron said that Paris will not apologize or repent for its atrocities committed during the conflict, but rather take symbolic measures aimed at reconciliation. Political analyst Sami Hamdine believes France is not sincerely sorry for crimes it committed against the Algerians.
I don't think it's necessarily a sincere repentance on the part of France. France tends to offer these piecemeal apologies for these particular crimes, but maintains this overarching narrative that France was on a civilizing mission, that France does not necessarily regret what it did, and it rather treats these incidents as sort of transgressions outside of a general framework within which France was operating into the benefit of Algeria. So I don't think this necessarily changes the narrative. I don't think this necessarily satisfies what many Algerians have been calling for, which is a sincere sense of remorse from France, a sort of setting aside and turning the page in relation. So it's not a matter of a little too little, too little too late. It's more an issue of still we don't hear a wholehearted remorseful apology for the crimes that France perpetrated in Algeria.
The United States and the European Union have imposed fresh sanctions on Russia over the alleged poisoning and jailing of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Earlier in our News Review program, we discussed this issue in detail with our guests. Here it is.
On this News Review, Russia has slammed as absolutely unacceptable the latest sanctions the U.S. and EU announced over the poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin said the sanctions amount to interference in Russia's domestic affairs. It said that Russia will take reciprocal steps in a way that best serves its interests. Earlier, the foreign ministry also warned the U.S. not to play with fire. It said the sanctions were evidence of a hostile, anti-Russian lunge. The U.S. and the European Union imposed penalties on a number of Russian government officials and entities on Tuesday. The two say the Russian government was behind the last year poisoning of Navalny. Moscow strongly denies that. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have veteran journalist and commentator Fred Weir joining us from Moscow. Also, we have historian, journalist, and author Mr. Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Weir in Moscow. What are your thoughts on the recent sanctions implemented upon Moscow?
Well, these are targeted sanctions, that is, individuals, namely in the security services, higher echelon government officials. And they're mainly people who aren't allowed to have bank accounts in the West, or who typically travel there. So what Russia is really responding to is not the physical pain, but the insult, the sense that these sanctions just keep escalating. It's been 7 years now. They keep going on, ratcheting up every year for every reason. I think the Russians are trying to find language, perhaps gestures, to tell the United States and the European Union as well, in different ways, that it's enough, that we really need to break this cycle.
Marcus Papadopoulos, the Kremlin says that the sanctions amount to interference in Russia's domestic affairs. Do you agree with that assessment? And also give us your perspective on these recent sanctions.
Well, the Alexei Navalny affair has to be seen in the context of superpower rivalry, specifically that Russia is again a superpower and America, the dominant superpower in the world, is attempting to undermine Russia's newfound status as a superpower. And the Americans are attempting to undermine Russia through a number of means, including the expansion of NATO to the western borders of the Russian Federation. We must remember that NATO is a dangerously criminal and violent military bloc. The Americans are also attempting to undermine Russia through the targeting of countries in the world which are strategic friends and allies to Moscow, including Cuba, Venezuela, Syria, and Iran. And the Americans are also attempting to undermine Russia through economic means, specifically sanctions. Now, the Americans care little for human rights, and the Americans in private know very well that Alexei Navalny's standing amongst the Russian public is negligible. The overwhelming majority of the Russian population do not just dislike Alexei Navalny, they loathe Alexei Navalny. They consider him to be an agent of the West. But for the Americans, they see Alexei Navalny as a useful tool in the demonization of Russia. They see Alexei Navalny as a pretext to introduce additional sanctions on Russia in the hope of asphyxiating the Russian economy, which would bring about a collapse of Russia's newfound status as a superpower, leaving America as it was during the 1990s and for most of the 2000s as the only superpower in the world. If the Americans sincerely believe that they have a case in support of Alexei Navalny, that he was poisoned, then they should share their scientific and medical findings with the Russian authorities. But they won't do that, which begs the question, why will they not share their findings with Russia? Interestingly, the British authorities never shared their medical and scientific findings with the Russians regarding what happened to the Skripals in Salisbury in 2018, Shrael.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Mr. Fred, we are joining us from Moscow. Also, thanks to Marcus Papadopoulos joining us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
in the limelight. Researchers say sharks eat grazing animals that feed on aquatic plants like seagrass, which helps maintain water clarity, stores carbon dioxide, and houses fish and other organisms that can keep seas healthy. We now present you an article written by Howard Cohen. The piece is titled "Study Finds Sharks Can Help Marine Ecosystems Survive Effects of Climate Change." The article has been taken from the BangorDailyNews.com website. Please stay with us for more of Howard Cohen's article. When a major hurricane, extreme heat or other climate threat devastates an ocean's lifeblood, its recovery could be aided by the presence of sharks. Sharks as oceanic medics. That's the idea behind a study on sharks and their role in the ocean. The study, led by researchers at Florida International University, FIU, was published in the Journal of Animal Ecology. The Florida International University scientists said, "Decimate sharks and you've made oceans less resilient to extreme climate events." Researchers at the University of Washington and Deakin University in Victoria, Australia also contributed to the new research study. The study was conducted from May 2013 through to August of 2014 and funded through a combination of National Science Foundation Rapid Response Grant and fellowship awards and public donations. The team included lead author Rob Nowicki, a research affiliate at Sarasota Moat Marine Laboratory. He was joined by co-author Mike Heithouse, a marine ecologist and dean of Florida International University's College of Arts, Sciences and Education, and Florida International University seagrass expert James Forkeran. The team found that predators like some sharks, including tiger sharks in this study, are critical for maintaining stability and biodiversity in the world's oceans. The study found sharks are important in helping ecosystems recover when devastation hits from hurricanes or marine heat waves. The researchers say sharks eat grazing animals that feed on aquatic plants like seagrass, which helps maintain water clarity, stores carbon dioxide, and houses fish and other organisms that can keep the seas healthy. To reach its conclusion, the team conducted a 16-month study in Shark Bay, Australia, an area populated by tiger sharks and dugongs, a cousin of the Florida manatee. Dugongs are strictly marine animals, whereas manatees can thrive in freshwater areas. The study said grazing animals, including turtles and dugongs, eat seagrass. Sharks eat the grazers. Grazers fear the sharks, so when sharks are around, the grazers often avoid the area. While the grazers are away, the aquatic plants have time to grow and recover. When an extreme climate event strikes, the ecosystem must deal with a whole new set of variables that require time to recover. Shark Bay was selected because a historic heat wave had decimated much of the bay's seagrass canopy in 2011. Researchers found recovery was slow, but was aided by the seasonal presence of sharks. The grazers feed on shallow seagrass meadows, but swim to deeper waters until sharks leave in winter. But the 2011 heat wave destroyed much of the shallow seagrass canopy, and the dugongs munched much of what was left. Researchers wanted to know what would happen if the sharks didn't return during the summer months and the dugongs had free rein to eat up the grass. In April and May 2013, the team placed 30 experimental plots, 2 to 3 meters deep, in 2 seagrass banks in Shark Bay. Florida International University reported by using previous calculations of how many dugongs were around and how much they ate, researchers were able to mimic the way dugongs feed on the seagrass in the summer months and what it would be like if there was no sharks around. Florida International University said in a news release, their experiment left the area with no recovery time, meaning if the dugongs grazed year-round, they'd end up inadvertently destroying the critically important seagrass canopy. The research shows that when top predators are gone, not only does the structure of the ecosystem break down, but it's also all but impossible for the ecosystem to stage a comeback. The lead author of the new research, Nowicki, said in a statement, "One of the reasons we did this study is because we think it's important to be thinking about how everything is linked, and sometimes those linkages are surprising." He added, "But they show climate resilience is not something that happens on its own. It happens in conjunction with species conservation." Co-author of the report, Heithaus, added, "Every ecosystem on the planet depends on a delicate balance of relationships. The findings fulfill one of the study's goals to keep the links linked, meaning conserving predators and prey." Nowicki said, "Ultimately, to rein in climatic extremes that are becoming more common and intense, we know we need to cut carbon dioxide emissions and carbon production, but that's going to take time," adding, "It's almost like we're on a leaky boat with a hole. We need to fix the boat at some point, but in the meantime, we can grab a bucket and get the water out. That's kind of what we're doing here. We're making the case that protecting predator species and keeping these species' relationships can actually lead to resilience to these events. It can buy us time, and we need as much time as we can get."
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kazimiya and then later they were moved to Najaf and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16 and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. The teacher is mainly concerned with the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, jurists, and philosophers all across the nation of Islam. With me in the studio are two dear experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtazizadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Rezazadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Good to be here.
So, we have started a new series on one of the most outstanding philosophers, thinkers, and jurists of contemporary Iraq. He was really a great Shia scholar, We missed him at the age of 46. He was assassinated and martyred by the Basque regime of Saddam in Iraq. He's no one but Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Assad. Really a mastermind and really a genius regarding Islamic fiqh, usul, philosophy, epistemology, and Islamic economics. Okay, regarding Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assad, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh, one of the most outstanding books that he authored is the book Iqtisaduna, Our Economics. This was really a great book regarding Islamic economics. It has been translated into English, and it is one of the magnum opus of Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assad. What is outstanding about this book regarding Islamic economics is the model that was introduced, and according to Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assad himself, what is introduced throughout this book is the a kind of maktab, I mean a school of thought regarding Islamic economics, not the economic science in terms of what we know in today's world, we can say with all these statistics and the numbers and the digits. First of all, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi explained this for us. Why Shahid Baqir Assad considered it as a maktab and not a science, economics I mean?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Iqtisaduna, our economics, is consisted of two volumes. And in volume one, there are two parts. In the second part, you can find a title as Economy as a Whole or Islamic Economy as a Whole. There's a chapter in it. Basically, in the first volume, when he's talking about the materialism, like the Marxism or the communism and capitalism, after that, it comes to the Islamic economy. And there he's trying to explain the idea that you just mentioned, like as a maktab, why he's saying that. Mm-hmm. He argues there, he says, actually, we cannot say that the Islamic economy is something separate from Islam, from the religion of Islam.
That's right.
And it is the same idea as, you know, we say like the politics is within Islam, economy is within Islam, the social sciences is within Islam. Everything is the part of Islam.
That's right.
There is nothing separate. And that's what he's basically trying to explain over here.
That's right.
He's saying when we talk about, when we say that there is an Islamic economy, it does not mean that it is a science that you will go and learn about it. Mm-hmm. It means that you need to live according to the rulings of Islam.
That's right.
And there, when you're following the rulings of Islam, you're living a life in which you have the Islamic economy.
Okay.
So this economy is not separate. And then he says, like, there are three main things on this. The very first thing is the belief. Mm-hmm. That in Islam, because we believe in God, that's and right. everything has been sent by God, and there is a religion that we believe, the Prophet and all those. So we have to have this belief.
That's right.
Second thing is the concepts of Islam. You need to live according to the rulings of Islam, the concepts of Islam.
Very good.
No matter these rulings are in regards to what, you have to live. For example, if Islam says you need to be just, you have to be just in all aspects of your life.
That's right.
Okay. If Islam says you should not, for example, steal anything from anyone, it is in all aspects.
Okay.
Okay. So these are the ideas, the concepts.
So the first thing
is belief. The second thing is concept. The third thing is sentiment. You need to have sentiment towards what you're doing. So when you do this, you can apply this in politics. You can apply this on your prayers. And even he says you can apply this in Islamic economy.
Okay.
Because in Islamic economy, if you want to have an Islamic economy, you must believe in Allah.
That's right.
You must follow the concepts of Islam.
Okay.
Because you're following the concepts of Islam, you are being just.
Okay.
You're not doing. You're not oppressing anyone. That's why when you practice economy, when you're doing like your dealings, it becomes Islamic. That's why he says this is a maktab.
That's right.
It's not a science that you will learn separately.
So can we say that Islamic economics, Ilm al-Iqtisad, is part of the economy that Shahid Sad is introducing in his book?
It is part
economy
of Islam
as a whole.
As a whole.
Okay.
It's a part of Islam because, you know, when we talk about the economy, it's you invest or you buy or you sell or you give loans.
Transactions
that you're doing for the country, obviously, it's different for the country. So he says it's as a whole in Islam. You need to look at Islam as a whole. You cannot separate this thing as a science from Islam.
Okay, thank you very much. Dr. Reza Zadeh, the Hausa is famous for teaching Rasail and Makasib, okay, which are the famous books.
Fiqh and Usul, yeah.
Yeah, Makasib, okay, which are somehow related to, these were, both of them were offered by Sheikh Al-Ansari, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
Rasail and Makasib, isn't it?
Yes. Rasail is Usul, Makasib is Fiqh.
Yeah, Fiqh. But in Makasib, which is Kasb, very much we are close to...
Yeah, financial transactions.
Transactions. Yeah. But I think that Iqtisaduna was somehow... we can say a new look at the economy in whole and Islamic economics, with the differentiation that Shaikh Saad made between economics as a science and economics as a maktab or a school of thought.
Yes.
What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, Shaikh Saad himself, in the introduction of the first version of the book, he clearly says that, you know, his idea or his goal for writing that book was to do an in-depth study of the Islamic economy, and also expressing it or presenting it in a systematic way with a systematic model. And also he wanted to show the foundations and thoughts of the fundamental thoughts of the Islamic economy and clarify the differences of Islamic economy and other economic schools, and also the relationship of Islamic economy with the other parts of Islamic thought. So he wanted to do all of these things, and the result is this wonderful, amazing book that we see after about 50 years that has passed from the authoring of that book. It's still the most important book that has already been authored about Islamic economy. And Iqtisaduna by Shaheed Sadr, because of its comprehensiveness and its deep ideas that he is posing, is still very popular and is being taught in many very prominent universities around the world, including Islamic world, not only the Shia seminaries, but also the Sunni, for example. It is taught in Al-Azhar and in other parts of the world. But for us to have a better understanding of the book, it's also good to have a look at the different chapters or the structure of the book. For example, he talks about, first he starts with an introduction and critique of Marxism. He also talks about introduction and also critique of capitalism. So he explains these, and this shows that he was aware of the let's say trending economic schools, and then after that he starts talking about the main branches of Islamic economy. And also the process of acquiring or understanding the Islamic economy. This process is very well explained in that book. And he brings up with an idea of that he called Nazariye Tawzi'i Pish az Tawlid. The idea of distribution before production. And the other idea, which is the idea of distribution after production. He explains this. And also the production idea, the theory of production. And eventually he talks about responsibility of the Islamic state in Islamic economy. What should the state do about Islamic economy if they want to really follow the Islamics? So this was a very brief overview of the book. And as you mentioned, and it was mentioned by Sayyid too, we come to see two different important concepts which are compared with each other. He says one thing that we have is the science of economy. And he separates the science of economy and economic school, especially according to his idea. And he says that the science of economy is after finding the relationship between the economic phenomena in the society and also the relationship between economic factors and phenomena. While
the maktab,
maktab or school. Economic school gives a method, a just method, a method that is based on justice in order to set up a prosperous economic life for the people. So it's more talking about the methods. It's not about finding the
you know, objective reality. That's that is up to the science of science of economy. Yes. And he says economic school of Islam is different.
That's right.
It's more about the method, and as I said, it's what it wants to give us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Azadeh.
You're welcome.
Said Mohsen Nawi, what seems interesting to me about Iqtisaduna by Shahid Muhammad Baghir Assad and this look that he had at the Islamic economics is that it gives the people and the Muslims a kind of specific lifestyle. I mean, this is very important. I mean, capitalism and communism in their own countries, they have affected the system of the living, the daily lives of the people with their banking system, with their economic system, the transactions, I mean, trading here and there, stock markets. But what seems it was in the mind of Shahid Muhammad Baghir Assad was giving the people a kind of new look at their lives and applying the Islamic rulings in the life to introduce them a pure Islamic lifestyle through Islamic economics. We can find ethics or akhlaq in that. We could find social justice or edalat ijtimai in that. And these are the beautiful concepts that the people in the 21st and 21st century are looking after. It seems a nice model for the people to follow, isn't it?
Well, we should not forget that Shahid Sadr was a jurist. Mm-hmm. And it is the duty of jurists to apply the Islamic rules in the society.
Very good.
To make people follow the Islamic rulings. It is the duty of jurists. And what I can see in the, what we see in his works, even if we look at the our philosophy, his book, or the our economy, the book that he has wrote, Iqtisaduna, he tries to explain people that if you follow Islam truly, you will have an Islamic economic system. You do not need to bring a system from outside. Mm-hmm. It's already there. Mm-hmm. It's already been set. And everything is linked to each other. For example, you know the main difference. Yes. We are talking about his idea about the Islamic economy being the maktab and not a sciences. Why it is maktab? It is because it is linked to all the Islamic rulings that we have.
That's right.
All the Islamic sciences. For example, you know, if I want to define profit according to the conventional definition that we have, non-Islamic definition that we have, and in that definition, if I have, for example, if I tell you, like, I have given, for example, $100 charity out of 1,000, mm-hmm. what would be my profit? You will say $900.
Okay.
Because you're minimizing the charity that I have given. Uh-huh. It's not under the profit. It's okay. Something I lost. Mm-hmm. I did it for the sake of mankind or humanity.
Okay.
Whereas in Islam, this $100 is converted to 1,000, for example, dollars in hereafter. Mm-hmm. So in Islamic concepts, they do not count it as a loss. Mm-hmm. It is counted as a profit.
As an investment.
As an investment.
Yeah.
Yes. It is an investment. It is okay. A profit for you. It's a win-win situation for you in the Islamic sciences. Mm-hmm. So when you come to the Islamic sciences, when you link ethics with the economy, when you link political sciences with the economy, mm-hmm. when you link the social sciences with the economy, these all together becomes the Islamic
economical system. They will get to the justice.
System. Yes.
They will get to justice. Ethics is observed over there. Okay, so what a Shahid beautiful
said,
picture.
And what given? Shahid said is wanted to basically tell is, look, Islam as a whole is a political system. Mm-hmm. Islam as a whole is an economic system. If you follow the economic system mm-hmm. of Islam, it means that you're following the Islam. So the best way is to follow Islam.
That's right.
And you're following everything. And that's why, you know, in his book, when he came, he came and he argued about the Marxism, about the communism first, and then he criticized the capitalism.
Yes.
Especially that's happening. And then after that, he started to develop mm-hmm. the ideas about the Islamic economic system.
Yes.
So this is the main thing
He was also concerned about the natural resources and the distribution of these natural resources among the people, you know, based on justice. This is very important. This is what Dr. Azadeh also talked about the tozi or the distribution. You know, this distribution system has also been tackled by Shahid Sad, and also in the last two chapters of his book, he talks about the role that the states and the governments have these.
Because in the West, in the capital system, we see everything is for the investors.
That's right.
The old profit, everything is for the investors. And that's why we can see, like in the West, for example, 99% of people, like, they're protesting against one person.
Yes.
the Wall Street protest that we had. So, but in the Islamic economic system, we can see like everything should be distributed on the equality basis.
Equality, yes.
And that's
not amassing the wealth.
No, no, no.
Okay.
No, obviously, everyone has the right to live. Everyone has a right. Obviously, everyone needs protection. Everyone should have the best economy.
Okay.
And that's what Islam is talking about. Yes. Obviously, you know, Islam came to free the slaves.
Yes.
It voided the system of slavery.
That's right.
When the Prophet came. Islam came to help poor people. Like we have homes, we have zakah, these charities that we have. On top of that, we have mustahab charities.
Yes.
The favorable charities, we can say. All these things tells us that Islam is talking about a system in which we have justice.
That's all right.
And in order to follow that just system, you need to follow Islamic rulings.
And the money and the wealth and the possessions, the farms, the land, the natural resources are like the trust in our hands.
Yeah.
So we have to observe justice to that. And what a beautiful world will be achieved if what Shahid Saad said in his book is to be followed. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Rezazadeh, for a nice elaboration
regarding
the book Iqtisaduna and also Islamic economics as a maktab, a school of thought and not a science. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Please visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The U.S.'s billionaires have amassed democracy-distorting concentration of wealth and power as millions have been thrown into poverty, says Chuck Collins, writer, in an article published under the heading, COVID-19 has exacerbated extreme levels of inequality. It's time for a billionaire wealth tax. Here's more. What should good societies do when a wealthy few reap enormous financial windfalls during a global pandemic? While millions lost their lives, livelihoods, health and wealth, the world's billionaires and super rich prospered. According to research from Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies, between March 18, 2020 and February 19, 2021, the combined wealth of U.S. billionaires increased by $1.3 trillion, a 44.6% increase in space of just 48 weeks. The concentration of wealth is staggering. There are now 661 billionaires in the U.S. with a total wealth of $4.26 trillion as of February 19, 2021, up from $2.9 trillion on March 18, 2020, nearly a year earlier. For perspective, the combined wealth of the bottom half of all U.S. households, 165 million people, is $2.4 trillion, according to the Federal Reserve. Elon Musk's wealth grew by an astounding $157 billion from $24.6 billion on March 18, 2020, to $182 billion on February 19, 2021, a nearly seven-fold increase boosted by the rapid increase in the value of Tesla stock. Jeff Bezos' wealth grew from $113 billion to $189 billion over the same period, an increase of almost 60%. Mark Zuckerberg's wealth grew from $54.7 billion to $95.7 billion, fueled by his ownership of Facebook. Dan Gilbert, chairman of Quicken Loans, saw his wealth skyrocket by 559% from $6.5 billion in March 2020 to $42.8 billion on February 19, 2021. These are democracy-distorting levels of concentrated wealth and power, and many of these billionaires control powerful companies with the ability, especially during the pandemic, to consolidate their market share and monopoly power over large sections of the U.S. and global economy. Amazon, Walmart, and Target have all benefited from having their main street competition effectively shuttered under the artificial economic conditions of the pandemic. The wealthy do not always benefit during economic adversity. In the aftermath of 2008 recession, U.S. billionaires saw their fortunes decline along with anyone else's. It wasn't until almost 4 years later, in September 2012, that the total wealth of the Forbes 400 exceeded its pre-2008 recession levels. While some increases in billionaire assets mirror the overall rise in stock markets, the largest gains reflect their ownership stakes in powerful companies that have taken the advantage of temporary monopoly and home isolation conditions created by the pandemic. Online retail, restaurant and food delivery apps, telemedicine, big pharma, and video conferencing have all reaped windfalls from the unusual pandemic economy. Of the roughly 56 new billionaires that emerged over 2020, many are associated with initial public offerings at companies like DoorDash, Airbnb, and Snowflake. These unseemly inequalities are the context for a debate over who should pay for trillion-dollar COVID recovery packages. While politicians of all persuasions have largely avoided talking about how to pay for the trillions in deficit spending over 2020, the moment has now arrived. Around the world, countries are considering wealth taxes on surging billionaire assets as one source. Argentina and Bolivia are both considering wealth taxes to help pay for economic recovery. Times of war and crisis in the U.S. have historically led to the institution of more progressive tax systems, including the conspiration of wealth to pay the bills. In 1862, the U.S. established an inheritance tax to help pay for the Civil War. Levies on inheritances and estates appeared during the Spanish-American War and First World War, finally being codified in 1916 with permanent federal income and estate taxes. In July 2020, several U.S. senators introduced the Make Billionaires Pay Acto levy on a one-time 60% pandemic wealth tax on billionaire gains over 2020. By one estimate, this would have raised $420 billion for a healthcare provision. Several states, including California and Washington State, have legislation pending to institute a wealth tax and make their state's taxes more progressive with higher rates on billionaires. Senator Elizabeth Warren is going to introduce an updated version of her wealth tax proposal. Warren's initial proposal was an annual wealth tax on households, with wealth starting at $50 million, roughly the 100,000 wealthiest households in the U.S. The 2% annual levy would increase to 6% on every dollar of net worth above $1 billion. The proposal would raise almost $4 trillion over the next 10 years. A tax that exempts 99.9% of taxpayers yet raises substantial revenue from billionaires is good politics and policy. While members of Congress might be divided over a wealth tax, polls over the past 2 years indicate wide public support for taxing the wealthy. An annual tax on wealth will require a new set of implementation rules. In the meantime, Congress can move quickly to restore progress to the U.S. tax code, a system that has seen tax rates paid by billionaires erode over the last half century. One proposal is to institute a millionaire surtax, a 10% income tax surcharge on incomes over $3 million, whether from capital or wages. This would raise $660 billion over the next decade entirely from households in the top 0.1% and move Americans closer to a fairer system that eliminates the preferential tax treatment of income from capital over income, from wages and work. None of these proposals will succeed unless the U.S. shuts down the tax loopholes, offshore tax havens and dynasty trust that enable the very wealthy to hide their wealth at a dizzying pace. Taxing wealth to pay for COVID relief and economic recovery initiatives is only fair during a pandemic where lower income and people of color have been hit harshest. Today's massive concentration of wealth and power are disruptive to democratic institutions, social cohesion, and economic stability for all.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.